Hello and welcome back to The Games Gone Mad with me, Pete. It's a show where we cover the biggest footballing news and gossip from around the world, meaning today we'll be discussing whether City fans should be worried, what the future holds for Mesut Ozil, and breaking down the hand wags at dawn between Colleen Rooney and Rebecca Vardy. The Games Gone Mad. As always, I'm joined by Patrick Van Straten. Pat, how are we doing?
I'm good. I'm tip top.
Hand wags at dawn, another
pun. It is good.
Better than last week.
Last night, my wife like interrupted my reading to laugh at Agatha Christie. I was just like, why? I've seen this already today.
The incident has produced some of the best moments on Twitter I've seen in a long time. But we will cover that in a bit, so I don't want to tread on our future toes. What is interesting, though, this week is that we are actually both going to Football Daily Social tonight.
I know. Who could have predicted?
How are you feeling about that?
I don't know. I'm trying to decide whether to get absolutely battered or to control myself.
Our colleagues do become more manageable.
Tolerable.
The more drunk you are.
Well, exactly. But on the other hand, then I'm just like, the opportunity cost, you know. If I'm spending money at drinks with Football Daily, it's money I could be spending with, you know, real people in the real world.
It's pretty unprecedented, this, and that. It's quite rare that one of us will go to one of these events, but both of us at the same time.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's a special occasion, though, isn't it?
Well, we will cover more on that a bit later.
Okay. The game's
gone mad. But getting into our first topic, and that revolves around the situation at Manchester City and whether or not their fans should be a little bit worried. Now, Pep City have pretty much established themselves as probably the best team of the Premier League era, racking up 198 points and 201 goals in just two seasons. Pretty filthy stats. They're currently sitting 8 points behind the perfect record of Liverpool, which on the face of it isn't too bad considering Liverpool did sacrifice a 10-point lead late last December. But there are some worrying signs for City, and I'm basing this off a stat I saw on Twitter the other night from the lovely people over at StatsBomb, which revolved around the amount of shots conceded versus the expected goals per shot conceded.
Yeah.
But we can get onto that in a little bit. I just kind of want to have a talk about their actual situation now in terms of where they are as a team, because if you look at the last two seasons, the 76 games, they lost 6 games across two seasons, which is 8%. So far this season, they've already lost 2 in 8 games. And the more mathematically gifted of you out there will realise that that's 25%, quite a noticeable difference. Oof. So what are your thoughts on this, Pat? How have City started? Should their fans be worried about their kind of defensive frailties?
Yeah, I think they definitely should. I mean, like, they're significantly behind now. Still don't think they're quite far enough behind that I'd necessarily make Liverpool title favourites.
This is weird. Like, everybody's saying this and I totally agree with it.
Yeah.
Like, how far do Liverpool need to get ahead to suddenly become favourites?
They probably need, like, if they're like another 4 points ahead, then I'd say they're like clear favourites. But I'd say we're in a murky area now where maybe Liverpool are favourites, maybe they're not. Like, I think they're probably about even right now, because Liverpool haven't been perfect either.
Their record's perfect, yeah.
But they haven't actually been, like, I don't think they've even been quite as good as they were last year. But yeah, with Man City, it's a real, real problem. Like, they've lost 2 so far. And I mean, this is a team that conceded 50 goals over the last two seasons.
Yeah, I think 51.
But currently, you can just attack down the middle against them far too easily. And that's been the story so far this season. And I think everybody's looking for easy narratives, right? Like, there's the idea that, oh, okay, right, it must be Laporte getting injured. It must be Stones getting injured. I don't think it is those things, because they were giving up big chances even before those guys went down. And to me, the thing that's changed is Rodri for Fernandinho. And I think Rodri's great. I really do. I think he was a great signing. I think he will be great for them in the long term. But he has different strengths and weaknesses to Fernandinho, and right now you can get through them, and I think we're seeing that in the numbers. Like, you overall with pressing sides, right, pressing sides tend to give up relatively few shots, but the shots they give up are high quality because they tend to have the ball most of the time because they're winning it back really easily. But when teams break through them, they get really high quality opportunities. This is stuff we saw with Liverpool a couple of seasons ago, right? And the weird thing about Man City last year is that they gave up the fewest shots in the league, but also average quality ones. Like, they weren't high quality at all, and that was like something pretty much unique since we've had advanced data in football, we've never really seen that combination. This year, they look much more like a normal high-pressing team.
Yeah, last season, that combination is like an elite, almost unbeatable combination.
You get through them, you still only get an okay shot.
They're unbelievable in attack, but when you do break on them and they're scrambling to get back, you're still not getting a great quality chance.
Yeah, whereas now, it's like the shots they give up are the highest quality shots in the league. I think they have 0.18 expected goals per shot, which basically means that where the average shot in the Prem has like a 9-10% chance of going in, they now have like an 18% chance of going in when they're against Man City. So if that's the case and you concede like 6 or 7 shots a game, that's very, very few. But if each one of those has nearly a fifth chance of going in, you're probably going to concede.
Yeah.
So it is a big decline for them, and they need to figure out how to get around it.
Yeah, it's a bit of like not an imbalance, but an odd scenario where obviously City are leading the league in terms of shots conceded, as in the fewest, about 7 per game, which is like, I think second is Liverpool with 9.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like you said, they are topping the table for the expected goals per shot at 1.18. And that has been seen in the fact they've conceded 9 goals in 8 games, which is nearly double per game of what their stats were last. So I think it works out at like 1.1 per game versus they're like 0.6 last season. And granted, there's only been 8 games so far this season, but that is pretty worrying in the fact that it's almost double.
It would be less of an issue, though, if their shots have been going in at the rate you'd expect. So, for instance...
attacking?
Yeah, I mean, like...
But their attack is better than ever in terms of expected goals.
Yeah, but it's not actually in terms of actual goals. So, for instance, against Norwich and against Wolves, they were basically level on expected goals, and they lost both games. And they lost the Wolves game by 2 clear goals.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm not saying they deserve to win it because they gave up massive chances. And I think if you do that, you're going to concede. But if they'd finished their chances, it would have been at the very least closer and potentially a draw. So, yeah, I don't know. They're kind of using up all their finishing in like 8-0 drubbings of Watford. And then they're not getting their finishing in games against Norwich and Wolves. So I do think that kind of stuff will shake out in the wash. It normally does. But it doesn't really take many more of these results to put them really in a hole behind Liverpool.
Especially because Liverpool have been so strong in terms of getting results.
Yeah.
Like, it obviously is the whole cliche that, oh, it's a good team who grinds out wins when they're not playing well. But it is kind of true in that, like, if City slip up another couple of times in the next 10, 15 games, can you see them catching Liverpool? Not really.
Not really.
I mean, unless Liverpool absolutely capitulate.
Well, the thing is, though, Liverpool's defence hasn't been spectacular so far this season either. And, you know, Salah is still obviously excellent, but has taken a little step back. And Firmino has been their best player so far this season, I think.
Yeah, he's been fantastic.
There are definitely still issues at Liverpool. So, I don't know. And always with Liverpool, I feel like City have these injuries. City had these injuries last year. You know, they had De Bruyne injury last year. He's injured again. They've obviously got Laporte out, they've got Stones out. If Liverpool were to have comparable injuries, I think that this difference would be kind of easy to make up. Like, imagine if Van Dijk got injured, or if Fabinho got injured, then I think, you know, is it that hard to see, like, City clawing back 8 points?
Not really. I don't think anybody's under the illusion that Liverpool don't have the same squad depth as City, and they're very aware that a large part of the reason they got 97 points last season was because they were very lucky on the injury front.
Yes.
Particularly considering they went so deep in so many competitions.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously, if that happens for a second season, it's pretty unlikely in terms of the length of the season, the amount of games they've played over the last 2 years, that they will not suffer a significant injury. Depends who that's to.
Mm.
This is the thing, like, if it's Andrew Robertson, you can patch that hole. If it's Van Dijk, much harder hole to patch.
Yeah.
So going back to City, where is this? Where is this problem? Because I've jotted down a few like potential avenues or scapegoats. And you mentioned Rodri, and I was looking at the stats so far this season, comparing them to Fernandinho's for last season, and he's averaging less turnovers. He's got more pressures and regains, more tackles, higher passing percentage, and similar interceptions per game to Fernandinho's stats last season. Right.
Yeah.
On the face of it, those are all good numbers, especially for what you want in that Fernandinho role.
Sure.
So then how is he potentially the weak link?
Well, I think it kind of depends. When you look at tackle and interception numbers, obviously we generally think like more is better, and that's generally true. But also, as we can see, Rodri is putting on more pressure. You know, like he's pushing higher up to try and regain the ball. And when the ball goes past him, then you're kind of in trouble. Whereas Fernandinho might be you know, pressurizing the ball less and making fewer pressure regains, but he might be making the absolutely vital interception or the vital tackle when it needs to be made. Plus, when it goes past him, it might just be as well that, okay, pretty much any defender is going to struggle when they're, you know, a striker is running against them in the open field, as Otamendi has struggled. But it might just be that when it's Laporte, you know, he's just capable of doing a little bit more. And also last season, they had Walker, who was a year younger. Fernandinho was a year younger. Like, these might be issues as well. Like, it's really hard to pinpoint exactly where it's happening, but it is happening.
But,
and Gundogan isn't really helping out that much on the defensive end either.
Well, again, we can get on Gundogan in a second, because I do think he's entirely ineffectual.
Sure.
But yeah, okay, the squad's 1 year older, but they're actually pressing harder and higher. Like, the defensive line over the last two seasons has progressively got higher up the pitch.
But is that necessarily a good thing?
If
your centre-backs are much older.
Actually saying that as a bad thing,
yeah,
and could be a reason as to why they are conceding such high-quality chances in such numbers. Not so much that it's Rodri's fault, it's just the fact that he happens to be not necessarily in the wrong place at the wrong time, but if he makes an error, there's so much space for the team to attack into that any good team on the counter, every team will probably set up the counter City, especially considering the fact that you can just counter straight up the middle, apparently. If he makes a mistake, then there's no room for error. Or, again, you know that the chance they're getting is probably like 0.2 expected goals.
It might just be a matter of people like Cancelo bedding in. You know, like, Cancelo might
bed in.
Yeah,
he's barely played. Well, I mean,
yeah, well, he played on the left as well in the first half of the Wolves game. Then he went over to the right in the second half and Walker came off sick. But it might also just be, you just need to recalibrate the press a little bit, or maybe you just play like 5 to 10 yards deeper. That honestly might make all the difference. Like, it's really hard to say. But fundamentally, I trust that Pep will find a solution, because there's never been a season in which he didn't find a solution.
Mm-hmm.
But it is strange to see this happen against them. And if you were a team who was looking at playing City in the next 3 or 4 games, you'd actually be quite glad, because you want to play them while they've still got these issues before Pep works them out. And I do think that you're going to see a lot of sides really go at them over the next few weeks, because they know that they're okay. Are they weak? No. They're still going to probably batter you in attack, but you can score goals against them.
Yeah.
And it's not really looked like that's been the case for 18 months.
This is the thing. It's a double-edged sword. Teams could take the game much more to City, which over the last two seasons we've seen that they struggle with. Particularly, like, I'm thinking back to the game against Wolves last season, where they got a result against them because they came out and they just played football against them. They weren't scared. But in this season, they're averaging a Pep era high 2.87 expected goals per game.
Yeah, I mean,
which is pretty hefty. And obviously, De Bruyne is injured currently. For how long? I'm not sure. But so far this season, he's been pushed into like his number 10, like higher, more free roaming role, and he's putting on a 0.7 expected assists from open play.
Yeah, and normally
per 90.
Normally like 0.35 expected assists per game,
it's
would be like elite.
Filth.
Like, you'd expect, like, when David Silva and Mesut Ozil were out there, but Mesut Ozil, I think, has probably put up the best season long one I've seen, and that was when he was in the 15-16 season, where Arsenal were probably the best team in the league. And I think he had,
was that the one where Sanchez just absolutely murdered it?
It was when Ozil got 19 assists.
Yeah.
And he had, I think, like a 0.5 expected assist per game or something. Like 0.7. That's from open play as well.
Yeah, just from open
I think when you include set pieces, it's at 0.9. That's bananas.
That's stupid.
I've never seen anything like it.
Obviously City have this immense attacking power. Remains to be seen whether that'll even out. I mean, you imagine that would even out over the course of the season, that they will, even if they are a wee bit more frail defensively than they have been in previous seasons. I wouldn't bet against them just outscoring teams.
Yeah, though I think if you had a different coach, maybe they'd try and do that. But I think the thing is with Pep, he's always going to try and control the game, and he doesn't quite want it to be like, right, okay, we'll just outscore them and play end-to-end. He always wants to play the perfect game.
But
I understand that. I think that makes him better overall. But
they're playing like that and still averaging nearly 3 expected goals a game. So, like,
yeah.
Providing they don't concede 2 goals a game, in theory, they should be winning the game.
Yeah, and teams aren't always going to finish like this against them. Like, but that said, they've actually conceded, I think, about a goal fewer than expected goals would predict so far. So, I mean,
they're just under 10 expected goals conceded, and have conceded 9.
Yeah, so I mean, things could get worse before they get
games,
better.
Well, yeah. But you did mention about Laporte or their injuries in their defensive line, and historically, we've seen like take out one of their centre backs, particularly Vincent Kompany, in the mid tens, and they just crumbled. They looked a much, much more ineffective team, a much more scrambling defensive team without like this leadership of Vincent Kompany. Some people I've seen say that it's because Laporte's been injured, but statistics don't really back that up, as because he played the full 90 versus Bournemouth and they conceded 10 shots to 1.63 expected
goals. The Bournemouth match was like the first real warning signs of this. Actually, I don't know, even against West Ham like they had problems, but the Bournemouth match was the one where you said, okay, something's going on here.
Laporte played the whole game there, so perhaps the injuries as a whole probably an issue. The fact that you've got Otamendi and Fernandinho as your centre backs again. Otamendi,
sure,
he's a Premier League standard defender, but he's certainly not City's starting defender.
Yeah, though he was a starter in the season that they got 100 points. But yeah, he's a couple of years older, and like, this
is the issue though. In the season where City got 100 points, I think it would be very easy as a centre back to be a centre back in that team, because they were depended on a lot less than this season. Because it does seem that while they're still like leading the league in deep progressions against, there's more than ever before. And the defence is more exposed than ever before.
It was easier then. Like, the defence is more exposed, but I don't think it was easy. Like, I mean, I actually think it was really hard. I think it's always hard to be a centre-back in a pressing team, especially if you're not, like, a super elite athlete. Like, people go on and on and on about what an amazing defender Virgil van Dijk is, and he is. But fundamentally, he also has the advantage of just being faster and stronger than almost anyone he comes up against. If you're not, and you're playing in a team that does press really high up, you're going to get caught out a bunch of the time. And I mean, Wolves are good at it. Wolves are really good at counter-attacking. And like, I keep seeing people saying like, oh, this could be better defended. This could be better defended. And you're like, yeah, it could. But also, any system that ends up with centre-backs taking on strikers one-on-one in the open field is going to concede goals. You just can't. It's not sustainable.
Yeah, but especially if it is Fernandinho as well, who is a DM. Obviously, that is the hand they've been dealt so far in terms of injuries, but I don't think there's that much protection being given to them from midfield, especially with Ilkay Gundogan's inclusion, which, looking at his numbers, watching him play, I really don't know what he adds to that team.
He was amazing at the end of last season.
Yeah, but in this season, what's he done? He's not an elite passer. He's not creating loads of chances from deep. He's not a ball-winning midfielder in the sense that he's making however many tackles and interceptions per game. He doesn't pressurise a lot. What does he do? He just kind of mills around in midfield and is ineffectual.
Yeah, but it's just, I don't really know what Pep wants from that role. Like, I mean, people keep saying Foden should play, but I mean, and I suppose that if he can't get minutes now, then he probably won't ever get minutes, really. But it's all about defensive solidity. And the question is Foden going to give you more of it than Gundogan? And if he is, I'd play him. If he isn't, I think, yeah, I'd still keep him out of the side. Like, just because all they need to do, they could, if they took off a third of their attacking performance, they'd still be an elite attack.
Yeah.
Like, if they only had an expected goals difference per game of like plus 1.2, they'd still be the best team in the world. Like, so I think that
it's currently plus 1.83.
Yeah. So just take off some attack and find a, like, sacrifice one of your forwards and find a way to do it. But yeah, they just don't. We all talk about how deep their squad is, and it does feel like it's deep because people like Leroy Sané aren't starters, Mahrez isn't a starter, Gabby Jesus isn't a starter. But actually, when you look at their defence, their midfield, especially midfield, it's pretty thin. Like, if you ask people, if you say, oh, City's midfield is really thin, people start going, what are you talking about? De Bruyne, David Silva, Bernardo Silva.
All attacking players.
None of those are central midfielders, man. Like, if their central midfielders read Rodri, Fernandinho, Gundogan.
Yeah,
and maybe you count Phil Foden. That's
They're essentially the club version of Argentina.
Sure, though Argentina at least have got midfielders now. Like, Argentina are at least breeding them, whereas Man City could be like, yeah, we could just go and buy a central midfielder, and then they don't. Like, could they have paid 55 million for Ndombele this summer? Of course they could have, but they didn't.
Yeah.
They could have got another centre-back this summer. That would have been the smarter thing to do, but they didn't.
Although in saying that, it is kind of hard to foresee both Stones and Laporte getting injured at the same time.
But they've also played three at the back at different stages. He's played Laporte at left back before. Like, you do have to, I think, assume that at some point of the season, your third choice centre back is going to play a significant portion of minutes. And the third choice centre back is Otamendi. And then after
Would you say more than 2,000 minutes?
not necessarily, but even if it's like 1500, that's a lot.
Yeah.
Like, and then after that, your depth becomes, we can play Kyle Walker there, we can play Fernandinho there. That seems like a little bit dodgy to me. And it's not like City, I realise they don't have absolutely unlimited money. Like, this is what Pep said this summer. But they clearly have the money to do something. And they could have easily said, you know what, like, maybe we just take a 30 million gamble on a young centre. Like, PSG went and paid, like, 32 mil for Diallo. Like, you're telling me that Man City couldn't have done that? And then just sell him on if they don't like him. He's only 23. Mm. Like, there are things they could do that would be, like, ways to make themselves more robust. And they didn't do it. And I think Pep in some ways has the same disease that Wenger had, which is that it's the opposite of say a Ferguson, where Ferguson would go out and just get like a decent player who could plug a gap. Wenger had this thing that Pep has as well, which is like perfect being the enemy of the good. Like, rather than go out and get a guy who will be good and who will help you in the short run, they're like, no, let's wait and we will get the absolutely perfect guy next summer. But the thing is, if things explode, then you're in serious trouble. And in this case, what's exploded is Laporte's knee. So you're in real troublesome situation. I don't think they have anyone to blame but themselves, really.
I think you touched on it there earlier. It's kind of weird that Foden is getting no minutes in that Pep has come out this week and said that Phil Foden is the only player or one of the only players at Manchester City who is not for sale, not even for 500 million euros. And that he is Manchester City.
I mean, what does that mean in real terms?
Well, this is the thing. What is Pep doing? Like, he's saying this, but then he's not playing him, opting for a Gundogan, who I believe is pretty useless in that role.
Yeah, but Pep's a bullshitter and always has been. Like, Pep has always said this. Like, he said like David Silva, he's the best player I've ever worked with. Like, Phil Foden, he's the best youth player I've ever seen. Of course he isn't. Like, I'm sorry, he isn't. Like, this is a guy who saw Messi and Busquets as youth players. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm sure he rates him, though I think he also probably is aware that Foden shouldn't be for sale because the fans would go absolutely berserk. But I don't know, like, Pep has always been like this. He's always just kind of, like, said anything in a press conference, and you can't really take it seriously. Like, I'm sure Foden will play at some point, but yeah, if he's not playing now over Gundogan, I don't really see when it happens. Like, is the idea that David Silva leaves next summer and suddenly Foden is a starter? Like, maybe, but you could easily drop David Silva now. He's not actually that important to the attack.
He has kind of moved into a slightly more rotational role with David Silva.
Sure, but you could, like, but David Silva's still playing regularly, yeah. And Foden isn't. Like, so you could easily give those minutes to Foden and say they're an investment in our future. And even if Foden's a little bit worse, he's probably going to work harder defensively just purely because he's a young player wanting to make an impression. So, yeah, I'd probably give Foden a run out right now, but I look at the City squad as currently constituted and I think it's unbelievably strong in some areas, and in others it's like suicidally thin.
Mm.
And that's just Pep. That's just what he does. The game's
gone mad. Moving on to our second topic, which was submitted on Twitter by Alan Hayden, and it's about the Ozil freeze-out at Arsenal.
Mm.
Now, Ozil has been omitted for the third consecutive game from Emery's squad, and he's played just 73 Premier League minutes this year, and I think about 140 in total, all competitions. Sitting there at 31 years old on the bench, or not even on the bench, in the reserves, on £350,000 a week, contracted till summer 2021. What is Ozil's future at Arsenal? Is it untenable? Is it done? What's going on?
I think it probably depends what happens with Emery. Like, don't get me wrong, like, I can't see Arsenal giving him another contract, just because he's going to ask for similar money. And
he signed one 2018.
Yeah.
Like an extension?
Or was it? Yeah, 2018, yeah. But it's, I didn't really have an, it was a lot of money to give him on a contract at the time, which was a problem, but it wouldn't have been a problem if it weren't for Emery, you know, like Emery just doesn't like him for whatever reason. But Emery also doesn't really understand what his midfielders are good at. Like, he thinks Ceballos is like better higher up the pitch, he clearly isn't. He thinks Torreira's better higher up the pitch, he clearly isn't. He thinks that Xhaka should play, he clearly shouldn't. Like, he's just not good at working out what his midfielders are good at, which actually has been a bit of a historic problem for him. I think I'd still like to see Ozil play. I still think he's, like, behind De Bruyne, probably, he's, like, the best creator in the league. Like, he's the best attacking passer I've ever seen at Arsenal. And I include Fabregas, Henri, Bergkamp in that. Like, he's so... Mm-hmm. He does things that other players can't. However, Arsenal have built an attack which doesn't have a great deal of defensive work rate in it. Like, Aubameyang will run around, but he doesn't actually produce that much defensively. Pepe's actually got pretty good tackle and interception numbers so far this season, but he's pretty lazy. Like, you can see him just letting guys run past him, like, when you watch him. Lacazette is extremely hardworking. Lacazette's really good. And so was Iwobi, but Iwobi's gone. And so I don't think that you can really have an attack that functions defensively with Ozil and Pepe and Aubameyang in it. I just don't think you can do that. However, I think that team would score a lot of goals, like, if you paid those guys together. But it's... Arsenal aren't going to give him a new contract. The question is whether they try and cut it short and let him go, say, on a free next summer. But I could equally imagine Emery leaving next summer and whoever comes in saying, yeah, of course we're going to play Mesut Ozil. Like, maybe we're not going to start him every game, but we're going to get a bunch of minutes out of him. Like, I think if we had an attacking manager now, like a Tuchel, I think Ozil would probably get at least 1,500 league minutes. Like, because he's obviously useful. And, you know, especially when you're playing a team that are going to come and, like, sit back. When you're playing a team like Crystal Palace that are going to come to the Emirates and sit back defensively, Ozil is the perfect player to play against them. He really is. And Arsenal could use him, but it just seems like Emery has decided that they're not going to use him. And even when they could, it's like, no, he's not part of my plans. And I just don't really understand, like, benching that kind of player. Plus, I just don't think Emery has the juice, man. Like, if Emery right at the start of his time at Arsenal is within his rights to bench whoever he wants for however long he wants. But if he was benching Ozil and Arsenal were playing really well and doing really well, that'd be fine. And we're doing okay, but we're not playing well at all. And so at that point, then if I was the board, I'd start to say, we've got a 350k a week asset on the bench. You're not playing him, but what you're doing is also not good. So why should we trust your opinion that, like, we should just bench this guy and eat his contract? Like, I just think, I don't know. I just want Emery to leave.
It's also super ballsy from Emery that he comes in and benches probably your best player since 2014. Like, in that period, 2014 to now, I would say Ozil has been your best player.
And he's I don't know, man. Like, I think you could equally say Sanchez and
the best player's still there.
And then Aubameyang, yeah. I mean, maybe. But Aubameyang... It's difficult. Like, but Ozil gets a lot of grief for things that he actually doesn't do. And then he gets grief for things that he also does do. Like, he's not going to do a huge amount of defensive work, but he does work really hard in other ways. He drops incredibly deep to pick the ball up. He does loads of ball progression and yet still is an incredibly elite creator in the final third. Even last season, being played out of position in a team which could not attack, he was producing like 2.5 key passes a game. And that's by far the lowest of his career.
Yeah, but it was a different system.
Yeah, that's the issue. And he was in a different position. Like, yeah. So for him to go from like 4 key passes a game to 3.5 key passes a game to 2.3, I look at that and I think, yeah, this is just an organisation issue. And I just don't trust Emery, man. Like, the attack's been woeful the entire time he's been there. The defence has been bad. But he paid Ozil in the Watford game.
Yeah.
And took him off quite early in the second half, as I recall.
I think 70 minutes.
Yeah, and I think that there was this idea of, like, oh, the reason we're defensively porous must be because of Ozil. And it clearly wasn't. I think, like, to look at that game and be like, the solution here is never to play Ozil again, I think is a perverse way to, like, read that result.
But also at the same time, having Ozil on the pitch isn't going to help that much defensively.
It helps if your plan is to defend and counter, which seemed to be what Emery's plan was. Like, I don't think Emery's plan in that second half was, let's just concede 2 goals. Like, I think his idea was, we will sit deep, try and mop up their attacks, and then counter. In that case, you're much better off playing Ozil than you are, say, playing Xhaka. Like, Ozil's actually going to be really useful in that situation, because Ozil's he's great on the counter-attack. He's a great counter-attacking passer, which Xhaka isn't. Like, so I think, I don't know, again, this just comes down to Emery just not knowing what his players are good at, and it just pisses me off, man. Like, I'm just sick of it. Like, you look at Ozil's time at Arsenal, and it's like over a goal or assist every other game.
Yeah.
Like, in what was a pretty dysfunctional team for at least the last 3 years of it. Like, yeah. That's quite remarkable.
In the, like, 170-odd games he's played in the Premier League, he's got 32 goals, 52 assists.
We wasted his prime. If you go back and watch some highlights of Ozil. Like, go back and watch the highlights of the game that Arsenal lost 3-1 to Man United at the Emirates, where we absolutely destroyed them and we should have won like 5-2, where we had 35 shots.
Oh,
and
the
like
one with
18
David De Gea just did a madness.
David De Gea was just like the best goalkeeper I've ever seen in my life. And if you go back and watch Ozil's highlights for that game, they are obscene. You go back and watch like 17, and this isn't like the 15-16 season. This is literally like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, go back and watch.
I was
like,
in a pub in Brixton with Joe Thomas and Chris
Hamill. Mental. Go back and watch the highlights of that. Go back and watch the highlights of like us beating Chelsea 3-0 like at the beginning of Conte's time there. And you will see just like what a super elite playmaker can do. And it's frustrating that we wasted his peak just like coming fourth in the league. I mean, we should have won the title in 15-16, but it is what it is.
Say he is on his way out.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is what? He's over 30 now. Like you say, it could be a thing of who lasts longer, Ozil or Emery.
Sure.
Say he is on his way out. Where does he go? Because there's been rumours about MLS, but considering he's on $350,000 a week in London for the next 2 years, would he take a huge pay cut to go to the MLS? Not sure.
I think they give him ridiculous wages, though.
They might not. $350,000 a week is huge.
Yeah, but if they give him a longer contract. What club can afford that? If they give him a longer contract, though.
What, like, until he's like 40?
Yeah. They could give him like a 3-year contract at like 32. On $200,000, probably take it.
The Guardian also reported this morning that Fenerbahce apparently looking to bring him in on loan in January.
That's been true every time Mesut Ozil has been benched at Arsenal. It's been Fenerbahce are going to come in for him.
And then obviously Chinese Super League always kind of swoons around these players because they just have massive spending power. But what do you see happening? Say he does leave in January or in summer. Where do you think he goes?
The MLS is really the only one I can see, like the only one where they got the money. Like, I mean...
What, more so than China?
I just don't think China spend the money on him. They'll spend it on a striker or something weird. Like, because, I don't know, it just seems silly. Like, Arsenal have lost a load of money putting him on the bench, but to think that you can't get any value out of him this season is just crazy, especially in a season you let Iwobi go, who was our second best attacking passer. Like, it was Ozil and Iwobi, and now you've just, like, got both of them out the side and you're relying on, what, Pepe to do it all. Like, it's very strange. Like, I don't know. I think he probably ends up in the MLS. But,
yeah, but what team can afford him other than like, Galaxy, potentially New York City?
Yeah, who knows? Like, I genuinely don't know what the MLS looks like.
Beckham Miami's?
If he leaves on a free, if at the end of the season he's still here and Emery goes and an attacking manager comes in, I reckon he'll have a sick last season.
Right.
And then he'll go to MLS on a free. Like, that's what I think will happen. That would be the best case scenario.
At 33?
Yeah, and he'd still be fine. Like, because his skill set isn't really going to age that much. Like, he's always been athletic in that he can, like, he's not very fast, but he'll cover a lot of ground. So that will disappear a bit. But if you want him to stand in the final third and just find guys...
Yeah, he's not known as, like, a prolific ball carrier.
Yeah, well, yeah, though, he has kind of been that. But, like, yeah, if you just stand... If you're happy to stand him in the final third in MLS football and just, like, find through balls to, like, to fast strikers... He will do it relentlessly and he'll get like 60 assists. I don't know. I would like to see... I think it's a real pity the way Mesut Ozil's career has gone. I feel like we sort of ruined his life.
But to be fair, you're giving him $350,000 a week for the pleasure of ruining his life, so...
Yeah, but I watch football to be entertained and I think Ozil at his best was probably one of the most entertaining players I've ever seen, and it's just a bit sad to me. You know, I think there was a time when Arsenal's midfield, like, it was like Santi Cazorla linking up with Mesut Ozil, linking up with Alexis Sanchez, like, and Ramsey was there as well, like, and even Giroud, who's actually, like, quite an aesthetically pleasing forward, you know, because of his link-up play. Like,
And his general attractiveness.
Yeah, and his handsomeness. Like, it was a f***ing fun team. Yeah. And now it's just kind of like Xhaka trying to pass it to, like, Pepe, who tries to pass it to Callum Chambers, who is not on the overlap.
I mean, it's a pretty attractive or pretty exciting front three.
Yeah, is it?
Well, yeah, I mean, Aubameyang, Lacazette, Pepe and Saka.
Yeah, no, it is.
Your options are pretty exciting there. Midfield are a little bit less.
Well, so. I think Willock is the hope, right? The idea is that Willock's shown a good ability to get into the box to support the strikers. I think the hope is that he'll do that while bringing a bit more like midfielder kind of skill set to that role. Like be basically much more like a modern 10, whereas Ozil was much more like a kind of classic old school 10.
A little bit more balanced to that forward line.
And I think Pepe probably needs that. I actually think that if Pepe... The problem is, I think if Pepe were playing off the right, rather than like as part of a front two with Aubameyang, which is where he played when they played with Ozil, and you had Ozil behind them. But what you often see with Pepe is Pepe gets the ball, he comes back and he looks for the fullback to run beyond him, or he looks inside for a pass to what would normally be an attacking midfielder. But because Arsenal are playing like three kind of central midfielders or DMs much more, like, there's nobody who's really there to offer him that combination.
He kind of just looks like he's just dribbling the ball up his arse.
Yeah, do you know what he looks like? He looks exactly like when Arsenal played badly with Alexis Sanchez. Alexis Sanchez would receive the ball on the wing, run backwards, look for someone to pass it to, but Santi Cazorla was injured, so he wasn't there. Ozil was being marked because he was the only other guy who mattered in attack. And that was it. And then Sanchez would just try, would just clip the ball to the back post and the keeper would catch it. That's actually exactly what Pepe looks like now. It's almost identical because he looks inside. There's no one to pass to. He looks for the fullback to run past him. There's nobody there. So I think that once Bellerin's back, Pepe will look better. I actually think that with Ozil,
who's playing right back three now? Chambers?
Chambers, because Maitland-Niles got that red. I don't know. I feel like Ozil, the good thing about Ozil when he's, is he so intelligent? He used to solve a lot of problems for us. But yeah, he and Emery are just not having each other, apparently. So here we go, £350 down the drain every week. The game's
gone mad. Talking about Fallout, seamless segue.
That was good from you.
Move on to your headlines, and I do have three for you, but I trust the first one might take a reasonable chunk of time. So forgive us if we don't do the second and third one, because we can't really be bothered.
All right.
But the first one is, of course, one of the best stories I've heard in a long time, and that is that Colleen Rooney has accused Jamie Vardy's wife, Rebecca, of leaking stories from her personal Instagram account to the Sun newspaper. And she's done it in one of the most impressive shithousery ways I've ever seen. It is so good. I trust you're across the story, Patrick, because anybody on social media... Yeah. Yeah, it's unavoidable on Twitter.
It's the perfect story because it doesn't actually really require you to know much backstory to get it. It's just like you need to read that one post and it's incredible.
Well, can we just talk about that post as a piece of literature first? Because a lot of people are quick to criticise the Roonies in terms of like their perceived lack of intelligence. But this piece, this piece of writing is actually fantastic from Colleen Rooney.
What, in terms of building tension?
In terms of how she is... paste it, she's built up this tension, and then they reveal at the end with like this string of ellipses.
Are we assuming she wrote this and not like a legal advisor?
I'm assuming she, well,
I reckon she wrote it, ran it past somebody, they were like, we'll clear up the grammar, and then she showed it to a lawyer who was like, okay, we can say like it's her account, as opposed to it's Rebecca Vardy.
I'm going
to
give her the benefit of the doubt.
I want to give her the benefit of the doubt as well. I want to believe.
I'm going to give it to her that she wrote this, maybe did a couple of drafts.
I like Colleen Rooney a lot after this.
A couple of redrafts, and then let a lawyer look over it to make sure she's not liable for anything, or she's not like defaming Rebecca Vardy in whatever way. And then she's put it out, but largely the whole plot line and the development of the characters are all down to her.
But there were so many unanswered questions, right?
Oh, so, yeah, but this is why it's so good.
So basically, like, the idea, right, was that she thought somebody was leaking stories from her personal Instagram, so she blocked everybody except the person who she thought it was.
Yeah.
And then the stories she was putting up were still getting leaked. So she was like, okay, it's pretty conclusively this person.
She did this over a number of months. So
yeah, though I was
like,
after you've
months.
Done it, like, three... I suppose she had to, like, wait in between things to see what would get leaked. But it ended up being Rebecca Vardy, right? It's Rebecca Vardy's account. But
allegedly.
What's great... Well, no, it's Rebecca Vardy's account. That's undeniable, right? There was Rebecca Vardy's account.
Yeah. And she's got screenshots of the only person to see that. Yeah.
What Rebecca Vardy's contention is that she was like, oh, somebody... People had access to my account. It's like... Nobody just, like, allows their account to be like... Plus, also, I'm sorry, but hacking Instagram accounts is kind of bullshit. Like, people hack them to sell them. They don't just, like, get into them for nothing. Like, if somebody could get onto Rebecca Vardy's phone, I'm pretty certain that we'd have seen some nudes of Rebecca Vardy over the last few months. Like, so, this is bollocks. But my favourite thing about it is the idea of Colleen Rooney sitting down and being like, what's a story that I can leak that's believable but also slightly ridiculous? And so, like, the idea that she was going to go to Mexico in order to pursue, like, some spurious idea about gender selecting the gender of her next child. Mm-hmm. And that got leaked to the Sun. Like, it's honestly so good.
But, like, at what point did Colleen Rooney turn into Sherlock?
It's just great work. Like, I mean, I thought... what's interesting to me is that she had her suspicion it was Rebecca Vardy in the first place.
It's unclear whether she had the suspicion that it was only Rebecca Vardy, or it perhaps would have been a pool of people.
No, but she said, I had a suspicion. To try and prove this, I came up with an idea. So it wasn't like she was like, okay, maybe she did have like five people.
There's nothing to say that this was her first attempt, though.
Sure, but the fact that she said, I had a suspicion, or rather, I had like a few people I thought it might be, which is the way that, if that were true, that's how your lawyer would tell you to do it. Your lawyer would be like, you know, make it clear that you actually went through like a bunch of people and you really did your due diligence. And instead it's just like, no, I thought it was her. I checked, it was her.
There has to be some pretext to this, though, because how does Rebecca Vardy emerge as the number one suspect in Colin Rooney's
eyes? Exactly. There must be something there where someone's like, you know, Rebecca Vardy's a shady bastard. Like, maybe it was her. Or like, maybe she just knew like Rebecca Vardy had spoken to the Sun before or something like that. But she... It's really quite impressive. And like the time that she's devoted to it, I really like.
Yeah, like
I just
months,
think this is excellent.
This is like months of a plan coming together.
So good.
And obviously Rebecca Vardy has denied it and released a statement and claimed numerous times about how pregnant she was. Find out.
Yeah, I don't get that. Like, do you think that that's the precursor to some sort of like hormone defense where she'll be like, my baby hormones were all over the place.
I don't even think it's crazy. I don't know why she's mentioning it.
Yeah, but I think it's just sympathy. It's just pure sympathy, right?
I think she opened up her statement with being like, I can't believe I have to do this while I'm pregnant.
Yeah, I know, right? And then she was just like, and it was the first time this happened, you should have contacted me. It's like, no, rephrase that. The first time I betrayed you to the Sun, you should have contacted me. Like, and then you realize how ridiculous it is that she's saying like, you're a dick. Because, like, rather than come to me with the issue, you went straight to the public when I'd already betrayed your trust. It's like, what is the merit? Like, so Rebecca Vardy's denial reads like she knows that she's been rumbled and she knows Colleen knows. But what she's trying to do is give herself as much latitude as possible in the eyes of the public. Like, it sounds like the sort of defense where she's like, she knows for a fact that Colleen Rooney like has worked it out, and she knows for a fact that like they have more information than the rest of us. You know, I'd be amazed. She probably replied to some of these Insta stories being like, oh my God, you look great, babe, or whatever. Like, it's going to be verifiable. Like, but by saying, look, you know, we're going to do a forensic like investigation
forensic
of my account.
Verbatim cooked that.
Mental.
Forensic investigation of her account.
Yeah, like by saying stuff like that, you can then say to people, haven't you been, you must all know somebody who's been hacked on Instagram, because everybody thinks they know someone who's been hacked on Instagram, but nobody actually does.
Yeah.
Like, it's just bollocks. Like, so I don't know. I see what Rebecca Vardy's doing, but mate, she's done.
I mean,
she's done out here.
Yeah,
done in these streets.
It's kind of, it is very much she said at this point, in that like people are just, she's never going to, I doubt she's going to admit to it if she did it.
She's adduced no evidence
if she didn't do it, I don't know how she proves she didn't do it. Other than this, other people had access to my account. But that just stinks to me of like the excuses I used to give to my parents when they caught me like smoking when I was 14. It's like, I'm just holding those cigarettes for a friend.
It's bollocks. You'd be like, oh no, like that girl smoked and then she like blew it into my mouth or something. Yeah, you're like, yeah.
So it was like, no, I didn't replace that bottle of vodka in your drinks cabinet with water. That was like,
I did that with whiskey.
That must have been like the company. You mean I would take that back to the off license because that is shoddy business. And it's like,
did you not notice when you bought this that the seal was broken? Yeah.
It's like the most thinly veiled arguments or defenses ever.
If she really wanted to defend herself, she would say, you know what, like, Colleen and I are going to sort this out. And then privately, she would be like, we're going to go to the Sun and get them to try and reveal their source to us. We won't make it public. We'll sign some sort of deal with them that will not make it public. And then she would get Colleen Rooney to, like, say publicly, look, we've actually looked into it and they've confirmed that their source was not Rebecca Vardy. That would be how she'd defend it. So the fact that she's decided to go straight into the public sphere and be like, no, I'm pregnant. I couldn't have possibly done anything because I was pregnant. Like, everybody's just like,
what I don't get,
okay.
What I don't get is what she gains from it. Rebecca Vardy gains
money.
From it.
Money. People keep saying in the office, like, she doesn't need the money. I'm sorry, is that your experience of like the super rich, that they don't need to grift? I don't want to do like the reductio ad Trump, but like, he was pretty wealthy at one point, or he's pretty wealthy now, you know, in between bankruptcies. Like, he's a grifter. His whole family are grifters. Like, rich people love to grift. Rich people love to make more money. And while, yeah, they're making like 120K a week or whatever, that's a lot, but it's not like an absolutely obscene amount of money.
But say she does sell these stories to the Sun, I don't see how much she gets for them. Like, how much is the Sun going to pay for a story about the Rooney's house basement flooding?
If you do it a few times a year, I don't know. But like, it might also just be that you build up that relationship. I have no idea how it works.
I just kind of think, like, to somebody who...
Maybe she just hates Colleen Rooney. Maybe she's like, Colleen Rooney's an arsehole and like, I'm gonna get her. Like, who knows?
I just don't see the fee that a newspaper will pay for these type of stories being significant enough to do this for a family that has that big an income already.
But maybe this is just like Iago stuff. Maybe she's Iago and Colleen Rooney is Othello, and it's what is it? It's motiveless malignity. That's like the phrase that's used for Iago. So that's what it is. Maybe she's just like, you know what?
She's
like
bored.
I'm evil. This time I get how I get my kicks.
I'm also incredibly impressed at how successful and how well thought out Colleen Rooney's approach to this was.
I know.
Because the only place she was leaking these stories was on her Instagram stories. And like you said, limited to one viewer. Like, that's immense.
It must have been so satisfying to see that one viewer on her story and then, like, a week later, like, see, like, the Sun publish it. She must have been like, oh, this is great. Like, because I would have... It's like an Aesop's fable, right? Like, this is like a Greek mythology kind of story. Like, my technique would have been to do different stories for different people, basically. If I could have done that, to find a way to leak different stories to different people and find out which one...
With different, like, bits of information, yeah, like, significant changes.
Yeah, and then you work out which one makes it through. Like, that's what I'd have done if I had multiple...
Like, suspects.
But in her case, she had her perp. Like, and so she was like, no, I don't even need to do that.
I love that she knew it. Well, it seems that she knew it from the off.
It's so good.
It's like setting a mouse trap.
For a really stupid mouse. For like a really dumb mouse.
Oh.
And the fact she sold them to the Sun as well. Like, I mean, like, this is pure scum,
but
top to bottom.
In terms of the publication that would pay probably the most or gain the most from these types of stories, it is the Sun.
Yeah, but you can imagine, okay, I guess it's because like the Roonies are like Scousers. And I feel like it's probably particularly painful for them to like see these stories in the Sun. Like you can imagine, like, so I don't know, like, I just think that's an extra little like nuance to it, which makes it slightly worse.
But yeah, if you haven't seen the abundance of memes on Twitter about this, I would really recommend logging on and searching
Wagatha Christie.
Just searching their names, because literally I reckon you could lose about 2 hours to it easily.
It's so
there
good.
There are so many.
It's so good.
So that's enough football for today, although to be fair, headlines wasn't really about football, but it probably is my most enjoyable headlines so far. And in anything but football, a lot of people on Twitter were saying we should review The Joker,
mm-hmm.
which has definitely dominated headlines and social media other than the Rooney-Vardy spat. But I do have an issue with that in the fact that I haven't seen it yet.
I also don't care that much.
Have you seen it?
No, but I don't care. Like, I'm sure it's fine. I'm sure Joaquin Phoenix is excellent. But if it's a good film, it'll be Todd Phillips' first good film.
But that's not a stick to beat him with. It's a bit of a stick to beat him with.
He's been making films for quite some time. Starsky and Hutch is okay, I suppose. But like War Dogs was dreadful. I don't know. Like, I'm sure it's fine. But you know what? I've seen Taxi Driver. So,
I mean, I haven't seen it. So again, I can't really do a review of something I haven't seen.
Sure.
Although, to be fair, I did do that while working at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. But, you know,
yeah, okay.
No one needs to know that.
Yeah.
The other topics include KSI versus Logan Paul.
This I feel comfortable reviewing without seeing anything to do with it. I don't care. I don't want to watch two idiots pretend to box. Yeah, this is like a fight in a car park with budget. Like, that's what it is.
No, it's not even budget. It's, like, immense budget. Yeah. We're talking, like, hundreds of millions of pounds.
It's so obscene, man. I'm just not... Oh, it's just.
Also, I'd be absolutely fuming if I was, like, semi-professional boxer, like, coming up the ranks, putting in, like, 10 hours a day in the gym and stuff, just trying to, like, get your break on the big stage or whatever, get some money, and then you see these two fucking morons.
Just, I don't know.
Just swanning about.
If you told me that, like, I don't know... What's a good like Ryan Reynolds was gonna like box Brad Pitt or whatever, I'd be like, I'll watch the shit out of that. That sounds amazing.
Those are two actually significant people. KSI and Logan Paul. Who gives a f-?
Yeah, fair point. Fair point.
But the third topic is the news that Pitchfork released their top 200 albums and top 200 songs of the 2010s.
Mm.
And I've had a look at the books list, and it's a bit of a mixed bag to say the least.
It is a mixed bag.
We kind of have agreed off air that we would talk about this one because it has the most legs in terms of what we can actually discuss and not just character assassinating KSI and Logan Paul.
Got ya.
So I think we may as well get forward with that one. And I'm looking at the list now, and they've put Frank Ocean's Blonde as the best album of 2010s, which I'm personally absolutely fine with.
I don't mind it. Whatever.
Because I'm one of the biggest Frank Ocean fanboys there is. And I've also noticed that he is 10th as well. So he has two albums, Channel Orange at 10 and Blonde at 1, in the most significant albums of the 2010s.
Yeah, Frank, Kanye West and Kendrick all have two albums in the top 20 albums, which is pretty impressive stuff. I mean, it feels like a very Frank Ocean friendly list overall. Like, I love Frank Ocean. Thinking About You, fifth best song of the 2010s. Not mad at that.
I personally don't think that's his best song.
But it's his, like, it. I, well, it's I think, his most. It's yeah. his biggest mainstream hit.
But then again, you could say, well, Lost is massive as well.
But a lot of it, but Chanel, you know, like
Chanel, like, Nikes.
Like, there's a lot of stuff that you could put. And actually, I think that there are quite a few Frank Ocean songs in the top 200. But
yeah, to be fair, they are massive lists to digest.
How do you think? Okay, Beyonce and Solange's parents. Beyonce and Solange both have an album in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and both have songs in the top 10.
Yeah.
Because Cranes in the Sky obviously makes it, and Formation obviously makes it. Like, I don't know. I mean, that's quite a success for that family. It's mental.
Well, yeah, it's mad. But does Solange's album merit to be in that top 20?
I don't know. I do like
it. Is it based on that one song, though?
I like that album. But yeah, the song's the outstanding one on it. But I mean, there are bigger issues in this top 20 albums. I mean, like, Norman Rockwell by Lana Del Rey, her album, like, that album is at 19. That's not her best album of the 2010s. Like, I mean, like, Video Games, I think, is actually, yeah, Video Games is ninth best song, apparently, which I'm not mad at either. But, like, it just seems like a whip. Actually, I Don't Like by Chief Keef is in the top 20, which I think is super fun. Work by Rihanna, no. I actually think that We Found Love is probably a better song, or at least was more, but, like, seminal at the
yeah,
time.
But also doesn't belong in the top 20 of the 2010s. Like, the amount of songs released in that time, in my opinion, no Rihanna song.
But now,
is anyone near that?
I feel like I know an all right amount about music. But when I started thinking about this, I was just like, Jesus, like, maybe I don't know anything about music. Like, because it's really hard. Like, I'd have expected someone like Father John Misty, you know, or like one of those people to be in here.
He's further
right?
down the list. I did do a bit more of a deep dive down it. But he's, number he's five, somewhere around like 70s.
Like, Fiona Apple has a number five album. That makes sense to me. I thought it'd be much more Fiona Apple, like, maybe like Bon Iver, like, kind of type stuff.
They do feature, but a lot further down the list. And again, this list, certainly the top 20, is very like R&B, hip hop, rap orientated.
Which I like. I'm glad about it, but
I don't know how many people compile this list, if it's just one author or it's numerous heads coming together to form this list. But the whole premise of this is entirely subjective.
Sure.
Which is where a lot of this contention comes from.
Sure. I mean, I think probably To Pimp a Butterfly and My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, I'd say overall probably better than Blonde. I think To Pimp a Butterfly would reasonably claim top spot here. I'm not mad that it doesn't.
I kind of think the pageantry that came, or that preceded Blonde in its release, elevated its album as well, in that, like, there was 4 year wait until it was released.
Yeah,
then he went through, it was the Boys Don't Cry album, which then kind of fell apart, and there was like legal issues behind the scenes. Then he released Endless, like a 44-minute video album, then he dropped Blonde.
When you look back at this, do you not think, like, you can't quite believe how recent some of it was in a way? Like, I know 2012 is a long time ago,
but
Channel Orange feels like it's been out for 20 years.
I was so surprised Channel Orange was in the top 10, mainly because I thought it was released in 2008.
I can't believe Video Games came out like this decade. Like, there are genuinely songs on here that
I remember Video Games at uni.
Yeah, but like Runaway by Kanye West, like, that absolutely top 20. Completely understand that. Okay, if you were making your top 10 songs, obviously I think that's a ridiculous thing, but which songs do you think have been missed out here? Like, are there songs that you would have put in your top 20 here? Because I wrote down a couple that would probably make my top 20.
Who the fuck is Lil Uzi Vert?
Lil Uzi Vert? Okay.
Well, and how is he in the top 10? Also, EXO Tour Life with a 3 for the E. I'm not a big fan of that, just grammatically.
That's kind of his thing, though, man. Like, I've got,
like, being stupid.
Yeah, but there are
being illiterate.
Basically, yeah, pretty much. Like, but I don't know. Like, when I think it's not so much that you're like, okay, they've missed out my favorite song, but when you go down the list, you're like, how is that song above this? So, for instance, like Cellophane by FKA Twigs is miles above 2 weeks by FKA Twigs, which I think makes no sense. Bobby Shmurda is above 2 weeks, in fact. Like, but I thought 2 weeks I probably would have put in the top 10. Mask Off, I probably would have put in top 10. There's zero Death Grips in the top 20. I've Seen Footage should be in here. I've got Laura Marling. Don't see her. I don't think Laura Marling's not in the top 200 at all, I don't think. And like,
I kind of think Fiona Apple's inclusion in the album. So just, well, they're like, I just covered that base.
This covers all our white women.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that. I don't know. I just thought they do have Yeji in. They have like Drink I'm Sipping On by Yeji, I think, makes the top 200 songs, which I was pleased about. But it was crazy to me that we didn't see I've Seen Footage. And actually, though, that was the other song when I was looking through. You know, Monster by Kanye West? Yeah, I was just like, oh yeah, of course, that has to be in here. But I was like, I can't believe that's in the last decade. But then I started thinking about Posse Cuts from the last decade. And I thought, The Last Huzzah by Mr. Motherfucking Esquire isn't in here, which is so incredible. I don't know, like, to me, that kind of announced, like, there's no Run the Jewels here. Like, it's very surprising.
I think the highest I saw Run the Jewels was 47.
That's crazy.
But
what, like Close Your Eyes and Count to F*** or something? Like,
I know, I actually think it was their album.
Okay.
The album was somewhere around 50. But just the fact that, like, Rihanna, Drake are involved in both these sides in terms of songs and albums, I just can't get on board with that.
I like Rihanna and I like Drake, but yeah, I think are these the greatest artists of our era?
I think there's a difference between having a hit that is universally liked,
sure,
or like it's very marketable and it kind of charts well. There's a difference between that, a song being successful, and a song being good.
Yes, I agree. But at the same time, is it not inevitable if multiple staffers at Pitchfork have compiled this, that the songs which are universally liked are gonna be higher up? Like, everybody in the world likes All Right by Kendrick Lamar. Everybody likes Thinking About You. Like, whereas when you get into more difficult, complicated stuff, you expect it to be a bit further down. That's why I basically expect that it's going to be like... That's why it's quite surprising when it's not just the most popular song by each of these artists, like, in each place. You know, in video games it is, in 212, obviously it is. I don't like, sure. But
Azealia Banks, 212, sixth best song this decade.
I don't know. I love 212. I think 212 was hard when it came out, man. It still is pretty hard. Like,
to the tune of top six?
It's so... Oh, I don't know. Like, I mean, I don't actually like Dancing on My Own. Like, I know everyone loves that Robin album, and I like the album, but I would not put Dancing on My Own third.
The only good thing about Dancing on My Own is for people who, like, cover it with an acoustic guitar or want to go on X Factor. Like, I can't. Scott. Remember him? He covered it.
Oh, God. I have a bigger issue with, like... I'm actually... You know what I'm amazed about? I'm amazed they didn't put, like, the Hamilton soundtrack or something in here. You know, that feels like a real Pitchforky thing to do.
Branch it into musical theatre?
Yeah, or they'd be like, well, that was an album that was released this decade. Like, I'm amazed there's none of that bullshit going on.
Looking at the list as a whole, the whole 400 entries, it does, like I said, feel very heavily weighted towards, like, the hip-hop and that... The hip-hop? Sound like Doogie.
Oh, yeah, the hip-hop. The hip-hop.
And that kind of indie alternative songs, they get their token entries just to kind of keep some people happy.
Yeah, because
that's how it feels to me.
Yeah, but I mean, shut up. Stop whining. Paradise Circus, the Massive Attack song, was released in 2011 and it's not in the top 20 songs. Bullshit. It's one of the best songs ever. Like, Paradise Circus is one of Massive Attack's best songs, which is to say it's one of the best songs of the last 30 years. It's so good.
I'm not disagreeing with you, it's just so subjective.
No, but I'm right. Like, is it okay? Is it better than Work by Rihanna? Like, yes. Is it better than Midnight City by M83? The Made in Chelsea theme song. Oral gonorrhea.
That song is awful. Iconic because of Made in Chelsea.
It's so bad. You know what I hear when I see that song? It's just like, it's just somebody.
Jamie Lang's face.
Somebody whining about Spencer and chucking them. Like, it's nonsense. How dare they? This is the worst, man. They might as well have put that song in that Shakira made for the 2010 World Cup. Waka Waka.
Work by Rihanna featuring Drake.
Oh, whatever. Like, yeah, but that's just a popular song, isn't it? I've never particularly...
I have more issues with the top 20 songs than I have with the top 20 albums.
I'd rather, actually, now I think about it, that this was just songs I hated than that it was songs that I'm like, yeah, that's all right. Like, because I just feel like, how can one of the most important pieces of art of, like, the last 10 years be a song like Work by Rihanna, which I hear it and I'm like, yeah, I like this song. Like, that's how I feel when I hear that song.
Zero Substance.
I'm like, oh, yeah, it's fine. Oh, it's like Sorry by Justin Bieber. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's quite a fun song.
It says Work about 300 times. Yeah, and you're just, lyrical genius.
And you're like, oh, this is just fun, isn't it? You're like the greatest art of an era should be art that people either love or despise. It should not be art that everybody's just like, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, it's a vanilla song.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I'd rather, like, Break Up With Your Girlfriend, I'm Bored, is up there than Work. Because that song actually bangs. And also because it makes people cross. I didn't realise that, but then I got... people were really angry when I, like, put it on an Instagram story. They were like, this is a bullshit song. And I was just like, that's what I feel like art should do. It should be at least somewhat provocative. Like, fair play to, like, Kendrick Lamar, Kanye, Fiona Apple. Like, these are people who've actually tried to do something, as opposed to, like, Rihanna, who apart from, like, I like Rihanna. I really do like Rihanna. Like, and I admire her in a lot of ways, and I think a lot of her music is actually pretty decent. But, like, has she ever really made something that, like, really, like, pushed the boundaries of what was possible in music? Has she?
No, because it's just popular culture.
Yeah,
pop,
like, probably,
music.
If you were going to put a Rihanna song in here, it should be, like, Bitch Better Have My Money, or We Found Love, at least, because that's genuinely probably, like, that at least defined a particular, like, period.
Yeah, the same time everybody was wearing the Rihanna t-shirt from Top Man. Actually, you know, We Find Love, that video was filmed in my hometown, Bangor. In the bit in the field.
That's
was
what,
filmed there, and it was like owned. It was owned by this like mentally like religious guy who, you know, the kind of guy who has a barn.
This
was
she...
the kind of guy who puts like gospel on the barn, and like so when you drive past it, you can see like
I like that
a bit of scripture.
Okay,
and apparently he came out and complained to Rihanna because she was not wearing enough clothes.
Yeah, she was pretty topless. Yeah. But like, I thought you meant the bit where they're in like a high rise or whatever, and they're like, "This is the shittest place we've ever found." It looks like when they're in like, you know, the underworld part of Inception. It's like all falling apart.
Yeah,
that's what it looks like.
No, it was the field part.
But you're like, at least that song really defined a moment in music. Whereas I feel like Work, if you asked me when Work happened, I'd be like, yeah, at some point in the last few years, I guess. Or what were you doing at the time? Don't know.
Also don't care.
Yeah, just who cares? Like, it was just, that was a song that was an excuse for Rihanna to like wind on Drake, which, like, don't get me wrong, that's perfectly fine, but like, you could just do it privately. The game's
gone mad. So that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Game's Gone Mad. Nearly said winners and losers there.
Yeah,
that will be good. A good end. Speaking of ends, seamless segue, this is very sadly, well, actually I'm not gonna say sadly because that's,
yeah,
you know,
I wouldn't say it's sad.
That's presumptuous on, firstly, I'm not sad. And secondly, definitely presumptuous on the listeners. But this will be my last episode of The Game's Gone Mad because I am moving jobs this weekend to a new role at a different media company on Monday. As for the future of The Game's Gone Mad, I'm not too sure what will happen, but I trust Patrick in his leadership of it. I'll bestow it onto him. And interestingly enough, Olivia Dodd hosted 9 episodes of The Game's Gone Mad before moving on to a new job. I have now hosted my 9th episode of The Game's Gone Mad and I'm now moving on to a new job. So if you want a new job, I would recommend hosting 9 episodes of The Game's Gone Mad and then leave.
You know what? We went from a woman in charge into a kind of erratic blonde man in charge. And we don't know who will come in next, but that was a very short reign. So this does feel like it's mimicking the leadership of the country right now. So we'll see what comes next.
Wait, am I Boris Johnson in that?
I think I'm an aging socialist in that sense. I think I'm Corbyn.
And I'm Boris Johnson.
You're Johnson. Oh, I'm Corbyn.
That's well, so harsh.
Lives Theresa May, so.
Yeah, definitely. Bye.